So, it's a shorter title. I decided not to talk about capillary adhesion. But I am going to talk a lot about interfaces, because interfaces are often where interesting things happen that are hard to capture without including atomistic detail. And I'm also going to talk about fluids stuff. Most of the collaborators are in green here on that work, and Colin Denniston is here in the room. And one of the things that we heard about Tuesday, a number of people mentioned that many models coarse grain to the same macroscopic equations, and oftentimes people construct their microscopic models, say with Lorentz-Boltzmann or smooth particle hydro, strictly with the goal of matching those coarse-grained equations. And one of the dangers in doing that is that you can't expect, since there's many ways to go big, the bapping back is not unique, and you can miss all sorts of interesting physics if you just worry about the macroscopic equations. And so this is a little nanomotor. People often use a no-slip boundary condition. Here we have two stationary walls, and you can see that there's Couette flow that's driven by a concentration gradient and preferential wetting of yellow by the top wall and red by the bottom wall. And so if you look at the velocity profile, in this case, you get a nice linear Couette profile. And the largest velocity in the fluid is in the layer right next to the wall. So it's as far from no slip as you can get if you try to define a slip length that's got a negative value, or it's a very bizarre thing. What's driving it is the fact that there's a concentration gradient. We have Maxwell demons in our simulation at the two walls, which we're allowed to do. But if you had a big reservoir, then that would also be providing that. So we're not violating any laws of thermodynamics. Well, there are papers that do, so that's why. Yeah, so it's driven by the concentration gradient. And it can actually generate velocities of order meters per second and stresses in the megapascal range relatively easily. And in order to capture that boundary condition, you can't use what's normally done, which is to say there's a slip velocity at the wall that's proportional to the stress. That's the Navier slip boundary condition that's fairly well known. There's another term that comes from the fact that there's a gradient in the surface stress. It's not strictly a surface free energy because it's a solid fluid interface. The interfacial tension is not sort of at a plane. It's spread over a region around the interface. And so some of the stress associated with the interfacial tension extends into the fluid from the solid. And if you have a gradient in that contribution, then basically you end up getting a force gradient along the wall, and that force gradient is what's driving the flow, the fact that the interface is not a sharp interface. And so the exact extent and width of the interfacial stress term is important in terms of how much slip that you get. And that's something that's very, very sensitive to atomistic details at the boundary. And that's what determines this particular length that enters in the problem. And this term is something that the people, I guess, have recognized will let something that likes a particular constituent to swim up a concentration gradient. You can make little devices that are wet by one fluid, and then they'll move towards the higher concentration of that. And this is sort of the same aspect, the same force, but pushing the fluid relative to a solid stationary wall. But what I think there's a third term as well, it turns out. You can't get away just with those two terms. And I haven't seen anybody else consider this. Basically, your two components in the fluid will have a drag relative to the solid. But that drag coefficient won't necessarily be the same for the two species. And the slip boundary condition is all about the transfer of momentum from the fluid to the solid. if you have a corrugated surface, you have something big, it can slip easily over the corrugation, something small won't. And so in a mixture, there's another contribution that depends upon sort of the relative drag forces of the two terms. And these factors of concentration just enter from subtracting the mean mass flux. In this case, that's right. The concentration gradient has two effects. It has one effect that's strictly from the interfacial tension gradient. You could put this on. In fact, it turns out electroosmotic flow can be viewed in this way, because in electroosmosis, almost all the force is very near the solid surface where the charge is built up. And so you can view the electric field as giving you a gradient in the interfacial potential that has that same form. In this case, though, it's just the concentration. And so the concentration term sort of enters in both terms, but you can't describe it with a single coefficient, because the way that it enters in those two physically are different. So anyway, this is the kind of thing that no one put into a macroscopic equation, because no one guessed that all that stuff would be relevant. And so if you start by just taking what's simple, you don't necessarily get the right physics. There's another thing that we've seen, and this is, I guess, Colin Reese, yeah? Right, so what we've done, in fact, is to do the atomistics and then show that if you do the simulation with the macroscopic equations with those same boundary conditions, you can match everything up. So you can construct a macroscopic sharp interface model that captures that. This is a typical sort of phase field model, and that would be used for, say, fluid-fluid interfaces, and there were some examples of that shown. And we say, well, this has got to be some simple function that obeys the right symmetry, and these coefficients have to be positive in order to avoid some sort of singularity, and that all seems very reasonable. But in fact, it turns out that if you look in detail, this is normally negative. And we looked at simple fluids, and Colin has recently, I guess, looked at water and an alkane. Any particular alkane, Colin? Is Colin here? found that it's negative. And just to convince you of that, this is just looking at the response to a linear perturbation. So we have a sinusoidal perturbation that couples either to the density or to the concentration field. And we look at linear response. And the linear response comes from terms associated with the local free energy functional. And then the grad squared term just gives us a q squared. And so we should get a linear response that goes linearly in q squared. And you can see it does, but it has a negative coefficient, yeah? It's in an MD simulation. You just add an external potential by hand that could be whatever you want. You could imagine it's some sort of coupling to an optical field or coupling to an electrostatic, but we just put it in by hand, right? And this is linear response in the single phase region of the phase diagram. Static, completely steady state response. And so the end, what? Well, so let me get there. Thank you. this is what's assumed that the form should be. And you can see it's a beautiful linear curve. And these are different densities and different interactions and things. And what one would normally do is to try to get rid of that apparent divergence by adding a q to the fourth term. But if you try to add a q to the fourth term, you just can't fit this. I mean, you have to have something that would suddenly turn up at the end, okay? there's just, this is a Q-squared theory, and this goes down all the way, basically, to one atomic diameter in wavelength. So what's cutting off the divergence is the intrinsic discreteness of matter. It's the fact that you can't use a continuous field at these smaller length scales. And of course, who would want to do the phase field model and use a resolution that's finer than the atomic size? I mean, the whole point is to avoid that. And so as long as you use a resolution that doesn't go into this regime, you can't support those high wave vector components, and you don't have any problem. And in fact, one way of understanding why this thing does decrease is that if you imagine a really high frequency, a really high wave vector modulation, you couldn't even tell it was there, right? I mean, with discrete atoms, you just don't know of anything with a wavelength shorter than atoms. And so a modulation that varies that rapidly doesn't perturb the system in some sense and doesn't cost energy. So when you think about it, as Colin was saying, one of his reviewers said it was completely obvious and one said it was impossible. And and there's actually some experimental evidence, and you can relate this to the structure factor in the Q equals zero limit. Yeah? It's fairly far away. I mean, right at the critical point, things get rather hard to do in simulations, and so we haven't been that close. The interface is mainly set by the second derivative of this term, it turns out, right? Because that the cost of these modulations is dominated by this. So that's what ends up setting the width. And the fact that this is negative actually lowers the free energy of the interface by a factor of 2 compared to what you would expect from this first term. And what's interesting is you can just take these things which are fit completely in the single phase, so no interface whatsoever. You can fit just the shape of the coexistence boundary to get this. And then the model gives the correct interfacial tension and all the other properties without having actually fit the interface. You get the right interfacial tension, the right fluctuations. Sorry. I'll have to talk with you about that. It's not obvious to me that's consistent.
Yeah? I'm not sure I understand. Again, so it's just the key room to be treated.
Yes. No, it's insensitive to
he's saying the first term
side. Yeah. It's so expensive because of the side term that if you want to minimize
psi is local.
Psi is local, yes. What?
You can't set any length scale just with a local.
Exactly the local.
So there are two, okay, so what drives this this density gradient, and this is actually not where I was going to go to, this was meant to be on the side, oh well. what drives the density gradient is the concentration gradient. So the concentration gradient has a positive term. And so you're going from high density of A to low density of A in the two phases. Okay? And you want to get from the high A to the low A on a length scale that minimizes the free energy. And this positive coefficient is the main thing that sets that length scale, okay? In the process of going through that, you actually have a density reduction in the interfacial region that's driven by this term and costs relatively little energy because of this negative coefficient, okay? So this term ends up lowering the interfacial energy by letting the density go down relatively cheaply in the region where you're changing concentration. And so by having less density, there's less AB repulsion and less cost in that interfacial region. But this is what sets the length scale, and that one is positive. What? No. No. And that's surprising. And, you know, so people shake their head, but you can go through and every case after case, this is what comes out. Yeah?
How do you measure it in a single phase?
Yeah, we take a single phase, so it's 80% A.
Oh, you mean that?
Yeah, it's in the single phase region of the phase diagram. Okay?
How large is the size? On the other side, the size and a large compared to molecular scale. How large is it compared to that molecular scale?
How large is.
Correlation.
I didn't even know that I defined it, but maybe I... So it actually turns out that we can change the interfacial width and that length scale from about 2 molecular diameters to 4 molecular diameters, and this square gradient theory and the phase field model works very well, even though the interfacial width is that sharp, which was a surprise to us. And you can get the right, but it works beautifully, and you get the right interfacial width, the right density variation, and the right concentration gradient degrees quite well with what you actually observe. So the phase field model can work, it's just you've got to make sure you put in things you wouldn't have expected. And the one last, this is all my preamble, and it's my whole talk at this point. We've recently been working on electrowetting, and here's another case where it seems like things that you would generally put into the macroscopic equations aren't what matter. So when you take a drop on a solid and you apply a voltage, there's a term that wants the drop to expand. That increases the area of a capacitor, and you lower the electrostatic energy. And so the electrostatic energy scales like V squared, and combined with the energies associated with the interfacial tensions that determine the contact angle, you find that the cosine of the angle should grow like velocity squared. And typically in experiment, that's what you see, and then it saturates. And pretty much every system saturates. It's hard to get angles below 45 degrees in general, okay? And so there's been this question about what determines that saturation. And there's been a variety of ideas based on comparing voltages to macroscopic interfacial energies, either by saying that there's some effective solid-liquid interfacial tension where you add the intrinsic one and the electrostatic, and maybe this could go negative. That's sort of out of favor, I would say. People have agreed that doesn't work. But there's other ideas based on the field strength rising to a point where it overcomes the interfacial tension of the liquid, and then there's some sort of fingering instability or droplet ejection. And so we've done molecular simulations of this, and I'll just say quickly, this is basically your standard short bead spring chain, and then There's a rigid substrate with a perfect conductor that's created by image charges. And then we charge the drop by adding a charge at a time to one charge per molecule at most, and we measure the resulting voltage. We independently measure the capacitance of the system and the interfacial tensions, so we can use those separately determined values and compare to the Lippmann theory. And I'll just mention there was some, the way we do this is using the electrostatics, is using a real space particle-particle mesh with a multi-grid approach,
which is very good for spatial domain decomposition type things, which is where we're hoping to go with this. And we've used this for electroosmosis and as well as electrowetting. So we haven't really used it in multi-scale yet, but it's a nice approach, I think, for spatial decomposition. And we're working on that now.
And so this is what you get. As you increase the voltage, it spreads like in the experiment. If you plot the angle, it fits the Lippmann equation with no adjustable parameters, even though these drops are something like 20 atomic diameters across. And then you get saturation. And what determines saturation is predominantly the length of the molecules. That's one of the main factors. So here, for example, chains of length 4 saturate at an earlier point than chains of length 8 with the same parameters. And the short story is what's going on is you have these very large fields at the interface. And when they're big enough, they just rip individual molecules out. And the barrier for that is very sensitive to the length of the molecules, because you have to pull out the entire molecule. But the interfacial tension, which is what everyone's used in the macroscopic theories, is almost independent of the length of the chain. It changes less than 10% going from these chains of length 4 to chains of length 8. And so you're seeing an atomistic or molecular property controlling this macroscopic saturation of the contact angle in the electrowetting case, at least within the simulations. Yeah?
So when you say the field pulls the molecules out, does that mean you get some kind of enhanced evaporation or something? Is that what you're talking about?
It's not really evaporation. What happens is the fields are lateral. And just to, so this is the maximum lateral field, and you can see that as you increase the voltage, that rises, and the maximum field at which you see saturation occur is the same for a given chain length, independent of the other parameters, okay? Now, at this point, the molecules don't evaporate into space. What happens is they move out along the surface independently, and so you get charged molecules that are tightly bound to the surface by this large voltage, the large charging, and they just move out along the surface. And so, if the field was on forever and you had an infinite thing, what happens is once the thing goes out, it then screens the local field. So the lateral field ends up being screened by the molecules that have escaped. So a few that escape, as long as there's anything trapping them locally, they change the fringing fields at the end of the drop. And that change in the fringing fields leads just to a saturation. Yes, individual molecules. Not that we've seen. I mean, the electrostatic repulsion is high enough that they just stay separate. Now again, so all we can say at this, you know, to say that this is, that none of that could happen in an experiment or in experimental systems, you couldn't have larger drops go off, and I think that's been seen in some cases. That's a hard case to make. But there is some evidence, for example, that larger ions give you a delayed saturation, which is exactly what we're seeing. So you can have systems that are the same except for the ionic size, and they also have this effect of having delayed saturation. AC electrowetting also quite frequently gives you higher saturation. And you can imagine that if the mechanism is pulling out ions, and different ions are being pulled out depending upon whether you have a positive or negative voltage, then this mechanism would be suppressed under AC field. So there's a variety of things there. Yeah? So I'm sorry, why do you say the time must be short?
Well, you have only, you said that the surface tension between 4 and 8 is not very much distinguishable, which I completely understand. And then you said that the spreading is a function of whipping off the chains and then they can move out the spreading droplet.
Oh, no. The droplet, initial spreading of the droplet happens without that. So the initial rise, this initial behavior is all just smooth, macroscopic spreading of the drop, okay? And it fits this because basically the assumption in the continuum theory is that the drop remains intact. And so then everything's fine. It's only in this regime that atoms get pulled out. And there's some... I don't see why that... It comes from the field. So if you look at the electrostatic field at the edge of the drop, okay, that rises with voltage, and when that reaches some value, then the force acting on one of these molecules that's right at the edge exceeds some value. You can imagine, just if you asked how much force does it take to put a chain molecule out of a drop, if you just... Well, there's only one charge on the molecule, so the force is on one particular bead, and... Oh, it's basically a Leonard Jones crystal and Leonard Jones interactions with.
It has atomic corrugation.
Yeah, it has atomic corrugation. We've varied that. That doesn't seem to be in a particularly important variable.
And if you really look at the edge, then you have a monolayer wetting, so glued to the surface, and the rest then is wet.
It's not a monolayer, it's very patchy. Because these molecules that pull off are charged.
It screens the field, so anything above this monolayer is then emitting.
The way I would think of it is you have a drop, and then you have like a molecule here and another molecule here. They're very patchy, okay? They're not connected to the edge. They're separate, they're outside. And basically, but they screen this lateral field. They don't affect the voltage directly, but they screen the lateral field, and the lateral field is what pulls things out.
If the ion is dropping on the same side, I cannot quite see the system.
So it's all a uniform chain length, 4 or 8. We've also looked at other lengths. And all the chains are the same, except some of them we have picked one monomer at random and added a charge to it. And we've just increased the number of ones that we've charged to increase the voltage. So you could imagine that these are molecules where some fraction of them have been ionized by an applied field.
It's not possible for you. But instead of having a field, you increase the charge.
Yes. And then we measure the voltage. Okay.
So, I should have known that things go slow.
So what I wanted to try to actually get to is some of the stuff that we've been doing on linking atomistic and continuum in a concurrent way. Some of you may know about this. Some of this is old. I wanted to get to the new stuff at the end, and we'll see whether or not that works. We have some experts in this kind of thing in the audience. And we've worked with both solids, which I won't talk about, and fluids. And the basic idea of this approach, which is similar to a variety of others that have been put forth, is to have some region where there's an atomistic and a continuum description that overlap, and use the continuum to provide boundary conditions at this end. The atomistic gives you boundary conditions to the continuum at this end. And if you've made everything consistent, that hopefully works out. There are people who we've used a coupling of either velocities or displacements. Other people have used forces. This is just the first in of the people who've used that kind of approach. We personally have found that the displacements and velocities are more robust because there's sort of no ambiguity in the position of the interface. And if you screw up your constitutive relation, it doesn't matter to first order when you do this, whereas any other thing does. So let me. So how does one do this coupling? As has been said many times here and elsewhere, it's easy to go from the MD to continuum. We have a staggered grid for our velocities. We use an incompressible Navier-Stokes equation. We want the velocity there. We average the MD velocities within a region centered on that, and that gives us the mapping in one way. And one of the things that we do is we actually have 10 to 50 independent molecular realizations. And we average all of those together as well as all the things in a region in order to cut the noise. And that turns out to be very powerful in reducing noise because any realization can have some long-lived correlations. And so you get rid of that by doing that ensemble average. And then at this end, it's harder because you have to have one constraint and many variables. And the specific approach that we use is we look at the accelerations, and we take the force on each atom, we subtract the mean force over that cell, and then add in the mean force effectively that the continuum would have. And by doing that, we force the average acceleration to follow this, and then we have a way of solving the discretized equations that ensures that this remains satisfied at all times. Okay, so we impose this, but it's discretized to make sure that this is always correct. What? Let me talk about heat in just a minute. So what's one of the things that's nice about this is that it's instantaneous. There's no time delay. Some of the other ways of imposing that have used a time delay, and then you don't get the dynamics right. This doesn't have any time delay. The other thing that I want to say, partly because there may be some people here who are experts and have heard something that I'm happy about, how do we keep the molecules in? Well, we have our coupling region ends here, but some of the molecules may try to escape. We have a potential that pushes them back and keeps them from escaping. But if we have a net flux, which we measure by looking at the continuum flux through this interface, whenever that adds up to one particle, positive or negative, we add or subtract particles out here in the region outside the region where we impose those other constraints. And that's important, okay? And then we have a robust thermostat in here just to make sure that we aren't doing anything funny when we add and insert particles.
Now, there was a paper which said that we were doing something wrong, and I just want to point out that the reason was they merged this with this, which they thought we had done, and they got problems as a result, but that wasn't what we actually did, and I think we now agree with them that what we did is okay, but they didn't understand it, and now it's in print, and that's too bad. Anyway, so this just shows that it gets the dynamics right. There's an analytic solution. The lines and the points are the continuum and the MV part of the hybrid. You start the wall moving. It takes a while for the bottom to know, and so you get finally an evolution to a Couette flow. And that's just sort of a classic test of this kind of approach. You can insert a rough wall, and the full MD and the hybrid solution give the same streamlines and all the other things you would calculate. If you try to use a continuum solver with a no-slip boundary condition on this rough surface, you get a very different result than you get when you include the atomistic. So when you have the interface, keeping the atoms at the interface helps. Heat was mentioned. So we've also looked at thermal transport in this. So then we have an additional equation, which we need the specific heat, the thermal conductivity, as well as the viscosity for. And the way we impose that additional constraint, again, in this region, we can calculate the mean kinetic energy relative to the average flow and use that to determine the temperature that the continuum should feel, okay? On the other side, we want to constrain the kinetic energy of the atomistic system relative to the mean flow to be equal to the continuum. And we use a really bad thermostatting technique to do that, which is velocity rescaling. And while I don't like velocity rescaling, it has one important benefit. There is no time delay, okay? And so if we want to do dynamics, this does not introduce any spurious time constant in the system, okay?
And as long as the things are big enough, and as long as you're applying this
out here,
so that the system has time
to heal by the time it gets into the region where it really matters, this seems to be okay.
And so this is just showing an example, again, a shared interface, nice Couette flow. This is the temperature profile. There's a gradient because the top and bottom have two different temperatures. There's a parabolic shape because you have more and more heat to get out as you approach the walls. And this is the continuum and the pure MD and the hybrid solution are right on top of each other. And you can see this big jump in temperature at the wall that comes from the Kapitza resistance, the fact that we have an extra resistance at the boundary between two different materials. So that's another effect that would be hard to get into the continuum, but easy to get out of the atomistic.
Thermal expansion? We haven't looked at that here. Yes. Now, this just shows the dynamic response comparing pure MD and the hybrid. And so we start to heat up this wall, and eventually we get a nice linear profile. But initially, we get something like this. And you can see that the MD and the hybrid are consistent. There's a lot more noise in the MD, which brings me to an issue that was raised yesterday. And fluctuating hydrodynamics can be very important in some things, and you might want to include fluctuating hydrodynamics when that's an important effect. But when your goal is to get a steady state average with minimal noise, it's rather unpleasant to have fluctuations in the continuum. It introduces very long time fluctuations that are hard to average out. We did, okay, and that would have more noise. This is at comparing 50 independent MD simulations and 50 of the hybrid ones, and there's much less noise, okay? There's really,
there's no doubt about the fact that if you remove the noise in the continuum part, you've removed some of the fluctuations. The fluctuations should be there, but as long as they don't get rectified in some way to produce an average result, which they don't in this case, then not including them makes it easier to solve the problem. Anyway. Well, okay, but if you take, let's suppose you take a very large system, okay? You take the system where the continuum part is huge. Then that introduces correlation times in the fluctuations that grow with the size of the system. And in order to do your ensemble average, you have to average over a time scale then that grows as the continuum part of your solution grows, and in principle gets arbitrarily large. But they do exist in thermal transfer. No, but the correlations and the fluctuations do exist. I mean, you can show analytically both in the. They don't show up in the average, but if you include the fluctuations in the continuum part in your simulation, then those fluctuations will be present there, and you're going to have to average over them.
Maybe I should comment on this. I think the very important part about the fluctuating hydrodynamics is really that it has to do with coarse gradient. So in other words, it really has to do how large the system is. That is represented by, let's say, singleticide.
Yeah.
And it is adjusted in such a way that the fluctuations that an MD system would have that contains, let's say, these 10,000 particles, that these fluctuations are exactly being reproduced by the fluctuating hydrodynamics. That's the idea behind it. In other words, if you keep the fluctuations on the scale of
Can I just be clear? I'm not saying that it's not a good thing, and that I'm not saying that the fluctuations aren't there. I'm just saying if you're interested in steady state problems, then numerically getting rid of them can lead to faster convergence.
Okay. Yeah.
That's all I'm saying. Okay.
You seem to be implying that these fluctuations would change the steady-state problem.
In terms of the average flows and average temperature gradients here, they don't. Now, there are other problems.
It's always obvious that fluctuations couldn't normalize the only one thing
that it depends on. It depends on the, let's just agree it depends on the problem. But let me quickly. So
if the diastolic equations were correct, the continuum, mm-hmm. not deterministic, because you assume that they were if they were already applicable, then yes.
Okay.
So long ago,
I know. I want to just really quickly get to no, but it's. We started a few minutes late, but I will. So there's this problem of singular cavity flow, where we have a moving wall, stationary walls. No slip boundary conditions tell us the velocity is u here, zero there. We get a singularity at the corner. Okay, and so this is a hard problem to resolve from continuum mechanics. And so we want to try to do an atomistic approach. And again, one of the problems that we have is that there's natural time scales that get bigger, the bigger the system size. And so it's very hard in a concurrent simulation to do dynamic problems with a large range of sizes. because you can only simulate your microscopic system over times that correspond to the relaxation time of relatively small systems. So what we've done is a multi-scale, multi-grid approach where we iterate the self-consistency at each size. So we start with a coarse solution, and then we use that as boundary conditions for a finer solution, and so on. And each one of these is solved with a different intrinsic time scale, but integrated to steady state. And then we go back up, and we wait until we get self-consistency. And lo and behold, we can get the flow field and the stress over something like 5 decades in length scaled in a self-consistent way. And we can see the 1 over R type of divergence that comes from the discontinuity and boundary conditions. We can get finite Reynolds number effects at large length scales. And we can see how atomistic effects cut off the stress divergence that's predicted by continuum theory. And we can see that, in fact, the total stress carried by the first 10 atoms near the corner represents 20 to 30% of the total force on the moving wall, even though the cavity is a fraction of a millimeter. And that's sort of surprising that the first few atoms are so important. And what we're doing currently is extending this to a somewhat less artificial case of two fluids where you have a contact line where the fluids hit the solid. Okay, the same singularity occurs, but now you've got to solve for the shape of the interface self-consistently with the stress field, which is non-trivial. And so the way we do that is to transform to a coordinate system where the interface is flat, so we just subtract off the interface shape, so we can work with a fixed mesh in this scale. We transform the equations to that coordinate system, so it's not exactly Navier-Stokes in that frame. And then again, we try to go to self-consistency, and then you discover, yeah? Yes. Particles done in the natural, and then we map the continuum solver to the other. Now we did this at first, and then we had a shock because things didn't agree, and it turned out that was because there was slip at the fluid-fluid interface. Okay, so the fluid-fluid interface is not a no-slip boundary condition. We have to put that into the continuum solver, or we don't get things to work.
These two Leonard-Jones.
It's two Leonard-Jones fluids with a repulsion.
Did you observe a significant drop in density at the interface there? Because that would be a good reason to expect slip.
Yes. It's, you know, reasonable size. So the constraints pretty much are like I've already described. The main difference is now I have to describe this interface, right? So I have to give a boundary condition on the interface going from the MD to the continuum. And so for the particle to the continuum, we basically find the average interface slope here.
And we force the position and slope to agree with the
atomistic solution. And then we have to somehow force that
interface direction the continuum gives on the fluids, okay? And so that's a little tricky.
And we basically insert repulsive membranes that have the direction given by the continuum solution that push blue that way and red that way, okay?
And
that ends up then constraining the interface direction. We have the interfacial tensions in the two cases match up. And we can then go ahead and solve this and get self-consistent results for the whole flow field and measure the change in the apparent capillary contact angle, the bending of the interface as a function of either capillary number
or the size of the system.
So here we're varying
the size of the system by several orders of magnitude and seeing how that changes
the result. It's meant to go logarithmically with R. If you have pure Stokes flow,
it does.
Finite Reynolds number effects
lead to deviation. So we can basically turn off, make the Reynolds number effectively stay zero, and we see the Cox prediction extend.
Is that the system scale?
Yes, the total size of the system, yeah. Yeah? And the answer is not really. None of the continuum slip boundary conditions that I've seen work terribly well because the breakdown occurs on such a small scale. There's a well-known theorem that basically anything that you do, you can't detect the actual form of the breakdown unless you can measure within the region where it's breaking down. And that length scale turns out to be very short. It's at a few molecular scales, and so most of the continuum approaches don't really work so well. But that's a longer...
That's a bit on the fluid there. I mean, you've got a paratopia, it's fluid. You have a binary fluid system, which was, had a phase current distance, say, between 80-20 and 20-80, then that interface is going to be broader.
And I can show you results on that, but I think I'd better stop the talk. But that's a long story. We found that the interface width does not act as a cutoff on the divergence. Yes. So I was going to show you one last thing, which was time extrapolation. You take little MD and you try to extrapolate. What?
Where's heaven on this plot?
Heaven? Heaven is when I stop, I think, isn't it? Now the idea here is just that you go, you don't want to do your MD for all time, so you do a little bit, and then extrapolate, and it turns out that you can actually get some results. They're a little noisy, and the problem is you're extrapolating noise as well as signal. And a lot of these approaches, like equation-free, they never really talk about the problem of noise. And if you want to try to have a coarse time scale, then you have a problem with extrapolating noise. You only get your noise going down like the square root of the time, and so it doesn't really help. Okay, so I better stop at this point, otherwise the chairman will be mad at me. And since I'm the chairman, that would be important.